Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. Sleep, nutrition and metabolism expert Greg Potter, PhD, is back on the podcast today with a new twist on health for those interested in sleep. Greg is an international public speaker, science writer, consultant and coach, focusing on working with individuals and organizations to adopt easy and long-lasting lifestyle modifications that add years and quality to life. His work has appeared in dozens of worldwide media sources, including Reuters, Time and the Washington Post, and he frequently contributes to prominent websites, blogs and podcasts. On this podcast, Greg joins me to discuss the use of psychedelic drugs for improved sleep and mental health. Greg talks about the types of psychedelics currently being researched, including psilocybin, LSD and MDMA, their mechanisms of action and their potential roles in improving sleep and health. He shares some of the most interesting results from the clinical literature, including therapeutic effects for treatment-resistant depression and the impact of these substances when combined with meditation or psychotherapy. So, Greg, it's been a while. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks, mate. Yeah, how are you?
Good. July of 2022 was the last time I published a podcast at all, and it was with you. Tell us what you've been working on since then.
Bits and pieces. Most importantly, though, I've actually met you in person, Chris, since then.
Oh, that's very sweet of you to say. Yes, I was very excited. My 9-year-old daughter said that you're no longer a pen pal, which I thought was adorable.
She's a smart kid, by the way.
She's great. Yeah, she is great. I've noticed this, all homeschool kids, they're super sociable. Maybe when they're starved of the opportunity to socialize through school, they try extra hard whenever they meet anyone, kids and adults included.
Interesting.
So tell us what you've been working on. I'm almost curious about what people have been filling their professional lives with.
I've been helping a couple of companies, doing a bit of work in content creation, but also helping a wellness company that we've spoken about briefly previously on the podcast with their platform, just providing ideas on a consultancy basis. Doing a little bit of health coaching, and I've actually started applying for jobs too for the first time in my adult life. So that's been an interesting process, just because I think the job market is probably quite different to how it was even 6 months ago or so. So if anybody listening to this needs a nerd to help them out with their project, and their project relates to helping people improve their health and performance at scale, then do get in touch.
Oh, that's very exciting. Yeah, I totally agree with you that the recruiting landscape has changed dramatically over the past few years, and then perhaps specifically over the last 6 months. Certainly here in the Bay Area where I am, there's a ton of people looking for work right now. And I'm sure the recruiters' phones are like ringing off the hook, to use an outdated analogy. So what sort of organizations are you thinking about, like employers or the military or someone else?
It's a good question, but I'm very interested in lots of different digital therapeutics in particular, and ways to help people improve their health and performance through lifestyle changes specifically. But obviously monetizing that type of business has been quite difficult, I think, for many companies. And one observation is that many of those businesses have started to transition to a B2B model, in which maybe they provide the platform for businesses such as pharmaceutical companies to monitor things like patient outcomes. And in doing so, they can probably improve the experience of patients too, because they're not just being given a medication and then have follow-up appointment several months later. Instead, they have guidance along the way that helps them eat better, improve their physical activity, sleep better, and so on too. And I do think that there's real potential to that type of business. One of the nice things about it is that's a business model that can be financially viable, but the users don't necessarily have to pay for it. And so I think, especially given many people's financial circumstances right now, that's really appealing to me as someone who's interested in working on those types of projects, because frankly, many of the people who need help most don't have that much disposable cash. We know quite a lot about socioeconomic status, gradients in health, for example.
But even at the other end of the spectrum, certainly what you're saying, I'm sympathetic to that idea. I can remember working for a tech company and sitting behind a wall of monitors, and there just being like a fog, like really nothing going on. And I was super good at meditating. You know, I could just stay there indefinitely and there would be not a single thought would enter into my head, you know, but that's probably not what my employer wanted at that time. And, you know, things have changed, like night and day difference since then, at least 10 years ago. So you can see how it would be in an employer's best interest and the employee's best interest too, but it's trying to connect those two things. It's like so hard. I think you've moved the problem around from, you know, when we're talking about these health changes on the podcast, you go from, or how do you get people to come in the door and start working with us when you're talking to the whole internet, to it's like maybe almost as bad of a problem when you're just talking to all the employees, right? Like if you don't know Greg Potter and you've never heard any of his podcast, then who the hell's this guy that the HR department is asking me to talk to? It's a really hard problem.
Yeah. And that is the position that I find myself in relatively frequently. Who the hell is this long-winded English bloke?
Telling me what to do. I feel like it's something that you have to opt into, right? Rather than being told what to do.
Yeah. I think my girlfriend wishes that she could opt in. Maybe opt out sometimes too.
Yeah, maybe my kids feel the same way. Well, let's get down to the serious business of talking about sleep and psychedelics. This is clearly the most important topic in health at the moment, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, the real reason I wanted to get you on to talk about this was because I don't think anyone else has said anything about this in the past. Like I listen to a ton of podcasts. I mean, I've heard people talking about sleep, obviously, and I've heard people talking about psychedelics, but I've never heard people talk about the two. And I think there are some things that are worth talking about. Otherwise, I wouldn't get you on. And otherwise, you would be willing to do this. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree with that. I think a few people have touched on it, but it's not something that's widely discussed. And also, as we'll get to, there hasn't been much research on it. And as far as I'm aware, there is not much ongoing research into it either.
Interesting. So why don't we start at the beginning with the basics and ask the obvious. What are psychedelics?
Psychedelic as a term is from the Greek word, means mind manifesting, and it refers to the drug's subjective effects. I think that term was first used by Humphrey Osmond in the 50s, and other terms have been used to highlight different aspects of these psychedelic experiences. So people sometimes refer to hallucinogens because of the effect of the drugs on their perceptions, or entheogens because of the effects on spiritual experiences, or empathogens or entactogens because of their effects on social and emotional experiences. But the way that we tend to refer to them now is as psychedelics, and the experience they produce is characterized by non-ordinary states of consciousness. And within that, people feel less self-centered and undergo some profound changes in their perceptions and their moods and their thoughts in particular.
And can you name some examples of specific drugs that would fall into this category?
Yeah. It's interesting because if we use mind manifesting as a definition, then you could arguably put loads of drugs into this category. But what we'll do is we'll just narrow it down to the classic psychedelics. And many of these are found in nature. So you've got psilocybin, which is in various different fungi. You've got mescaline, which is in a couple of different types of cacti, San Pedro and peyote. And you've got DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is in various plants, including ayahuasca brews. And on that note, ayahuasca is traditionally prepared as a decoction of two different plants. One is a bush and one is a liana. And it's interesting because one of them is a rich source of DMT and the other contains an MAO inhibitor, so monoamine oxidase. They're enzymes that break down different monoamines, including things like dopamine. And then also in the classic psychedelic category, you have LSD, which is synthetic, but you can get LSD-like substances from certain fungi too. And then separate to those, you have the non-classic psychedelics. And these arguably include things like ibogaine, ketamine, salvinorin A, THC from cannabis. But most people think of MDMA when they think about these non-classic psychedelics. And they don't necessarily produce the same types of sensory distortions that the classic ones do. And I think in this podcast, we'll focus on the classic ones in part for that reason. But if you think about MDMA, for example, then yes, you might experience profound changes in your emotions, but you won't necessarily experience anything like visual distortions.
It is interesting, all these different labels. They can make you feel a bit dumb because you don't understand them all. But I think they're just arbitrary labels applied to concepts that are understood between scientists or other people, but they're still arbitrary, right? And so just because you don't understand the label doesn't mean that you're like dumb, right? That's kind of how I feel.
Yeah. And obviously there are different classification systems that you could use. So some people will, for instance, split them into tryptamines or some other class of chemicals. Others might focus on their mechanisms of action. And interestingly, those classic psychedelics that I mentioned, they all seem to probably primarily act by way of the serotonin 2A receptors. They agonize those. So it is interesting that while those classic psychedelics have been lumped together somewhat arbitrarily, they do share some common biology in terms of how they act.
And is there anything else you'd want to say about the main types of psychedelics?
I don't think so, other than just to clarify that in this conversation, I think we'll probably mostly focus on psilocybin and maybe touch a little bit on things like LSD too, but that's mostly because psilocybin simply has the most modern research on it. Of the work done before psychedelics were outlawed was on LSD, but that hasn't been so well studied in recent times.
And what are some uses of psychedelics, and what are some of the mechanisms thought to underlie these uses?
Yeah, there are a few. It's interesting because you can look at cross-sectional data on people that use these drugs. And interestingly, there's some work showing that, for instance, lifetime use of classic psychedelics is actually associated with less psychological distress and suicidality. But looking at the well-controlled experiments that have been done, as I mentioned, psilocybin's been best studied, and the uses include antidepressant uses. It's also quite a potent anxiolytic, reduces anxiety. Interestingly, LSD definitely is as well, going by some work published very recently. And ayahuasca has also been shown to be an effective antidepressant. And going back to psilocybin, those effects surely relate to the fact that it can be so helpful in palliative care. So, for example, in about 60% of cancer patients included in some studies, their depression anxiety has gone into remission after psilocybin assisted psychotherapy. But there are many different uses that have been studied. So psychedelics can be remarkably effective in helping treat different forms of addiction. So psilocybin's been looked at for smoking, LSD and alcohol use disorder, MDMA, not a classic psychedelic, but that can be very potent in PTSD in particular. And it's interesting when you look at these different mental health problems, because there probably are some threads that run through them, one of which is excessive psychological rigidity. And I think that's probably one of the ways by which these drugs are so helpful in reducing that rigidity, improving psychological flexibility. But there are also some other conditions they might be helpful for. So, for instance, there's some work looking at cluster headaches, which don't respond that well to many treatments, but psilocybin especially seems to potentially help those. And then if you're a healthy person, you're not trying to address some sort of chronic disease or anything like that, I think that they definitely still have their uses. So, for instance, there is some fascinating work looking at psilocybin in conjunction with daily spiritual practices, so things like meditation and journaling, finding that it can substantially improve a sense of purpose in life, feeling close to other people, feeling gratitude. There's lots of interest now, obviously, in mini dosing and micro dosing. You won't necessarily have heard the term mini dosing used so frequently, but just to give you an idea, that might be something like 50 micrograms of LSD, whereas micro dosing is typically perhaps 15 to 20 micrograms. And depending on the dose, in well-controlled studies, these types of low doses do have some small effects. So small doses of LSD, for instance, can be somewhat stimulating, and they seem to have both positive and negative effects on cognition. So obviously it depends on what you're trying to do specifically as to whether they'll be helpful. And even these very low doses can increase blood markers of neuroplasticity, which could explain why regular use over time, at least as reported anecdotally, can help support certain outcomes. But then just going back to what I mentioned about healthy people, you can also just use these drugs for peak experiences. So you might just want to experience the world in a different way and experience this incredibly beautiful change in all of your perceptions that many people haven't had the chance to encounter. And if you look, for instance, at Roland Griffith's data, he did an interesting study looking at multiple doses of psilocybin, and he found that over 80% of people in the study rated one of their trips among the five most spiritually significant experiences of their lives, and 61% rated one of them as the most significant. So more significant than, say, birth of a child or getting married. And just on that note, while you might be interested in these peak experiences just for the sake of it, it is interesting that they do seem to somewhat predict different therapeutic outcomes over time. And related to that, scientists have tried to start to characterize the components of these experiences that seem to be most important. There are lots of scales that have been used to assess whether somebody has a mystical experience. And I use the term mystical experience because that's now widely used in research. And these have been defined differently over time, but there are some common themes. So one of them is feeling really good, so having a really positive mood. Another is a sense of unity, so feeling connected to the world around you. Another is transcending space and time. So you might lose your sense of time passing. It might be dramatically different from how it is in regular consciousness. Another is ineffability. So people find it hard to describe these experiences. And then there's a noetic quality. And you'll come across different definitions of that. But it's the idea that while under the influence, you experience some sort of reality that's somehow more real than everyday reality. And if you take a high dose of one of these classic psychedelics, then you can quite reliably occasion one of these mystical experiences. So a high dose of psilocybin, maybe 25 to 30 milligrams, seems to lead to an experience like this about 70% of the time, at least in the type of setting that is typical of research, which will be listening to music with a blindfold on and with a therapist at your side. So I'll pause there, Chris, but we can also just touch on some of the mechanisms that might be at play too, if you like.
No, go for it. Tell us about some of the mechanisms. You know, I talked to someone whose name I won't mention, actually, because they're kind of controversial, and I've heard them discussed on another podcast as a conspiracy theorist, but I wouldn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It was a very interesting discussion with that particular individual. And they said that trying to understand psychedelics at the low mechanistic level is a fruitless endeavor, that you'll never make progress like that. And there are perhaps other ways to approach the understanding that are much more powerful, should we say, and that like kind of things I don't really know much about, you know, like the mysticism word that you just used there. That's like not a word I use very often, you know, but tell us about some of the mechanistic stuff.
Sure. Well, I'll just chime in briefly with a comment on what you just said. I think I probably partly understand where they're coming from, but also if you do understand the mechanisms at play, then I see no reason as to why you couldn't iterate on psychedelics to create substances that have greater potential upsides and potentially fewer downsides, or use them in a more precise fashion according to the individual and their needs. Turning to mechanisms, there seems to be a few that have been quite well characterized, and some of them are a bit counterintuitive. So it's tangential, but it's interesting. As an example, they actually temporarily reduce total brain blood flow, at least temporarily. But in terms of the mechanisms that seem to be important to their effects, one of them relates to how different parts of the brain communicate with each other. So brain networks tend to be quite modular. There are distinct circuits for various different brain functions. So there's a circuit that helps us pay attention, for instance. Activity in some parts of the brain gives rise to mind wandering. And what psychedelics seems to do is disintegrate these brain networks. So they reduce that modularity that I described, meaning that circuits now signal to circuits that they didn't previously signal to. And those changes in connectivity that take place during, but also sustainably afterwards, seem to relate somewhat to clinical outcomes such as improvements in mood. And interestingly, there seem to be particularly strong effects on activity of some networks involved about thinking about oneself. So you've probably heard people speak about the default mode network. It's this task negative network that gives rise to mind wandering when you're not focusing on any one thing in particular. And in instances of depression and addiction, there seems to be excessive activity in this network. And there's a helpful analogy that was put forward by a scientist who used to be at Imperial. I think he's now actually focusing on a music related product to be used in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. He's called Malin Kendall. But he said that one way of thinking about how these substances act is when you're stuck in rigid ways of thinking about things, you're stuck in these thought loops. It's a bit like skiing down a slope. And just after a while, you've been skiing down the slope the same way again and again. It gets harder to get out of those tracks because they're so entrenched. When you take a psychedelic, it's like throwing some snow on the slope. And now all of a sudden you have the option to choose a different path down the slope. It's not always going to be there. And as you continue to ski down it, you're going to potentially deepen some new paths in the snow. But there is that window of time afterwards in which you can choose a different approach. And then related to that, these substances also seem to increase neuroplasticity in general. And there's been some preclinical work recently looking at some of the mechanisms that might underlie that, suggesting that it's activation of those serotonin 2A receptors that I mentioned earlier that seems to specifically drive that increase in neuroplasticity.
Yeah, that makes sense. You reminded me of, in computer science, you know, the classic problem of exploration versus exploitation. And you've just seen that with my kids, right? They're all about exploring the world. But then as adults, we tend to stop exploring quite so much and we get into the hard work of the exploitation part. And I still to this day meet people who have, you know, they've left university 20 plus years ago and they haven't read a book since, you know, like they're really stuck in those ruts. And maybe that's fine. But, you know, if you want to go back to exploring, then it seems like these drugs hold tremendous promise for facilitating that exploration. It could be that you're stuck on a, what in computer science you would call a local maxima, right? Like if the terrain has many mountains, you might be stuck on one of the smaller ones and you never know, like just pushing you off might have give you an opportunity to get to a higher place.
Yeah, well said.
So I can't resist asking you about your experience using psychedelics. Would you mind talking about that?
Yeah. Okay.
He says with some trepidation.
Yeah, a little bit of trepidation. But yes, I'm by no means a psychonaut. I don't have rich experience using these. And I had my first experience about 6 months ago or so. And it wasn't planned, actually. I was in Sumatra on holiday. Sumatra is in Indonesia, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. And I've obviously been interested in psychedelics and the science of them. And that was partly because I was curious about the peak experience, but also I just thought they might be helpful for me given my psychological disposition. Some of the things that I don't like about my mind tend to be quite obsessive, quite perfectionistic too. And that can sound like a humble brag, I think, especially in certain contexts, but it actually can be quite incapacitating at times. So as I mentioned, I hadn't planned to use them. I knew that you could get them in some place in Indonesia. So for instance, there's a little island where lots of people go on holiday, Gili Trawangan, Gili T, where loads of people just take mushrooms on the beach. But I wasn't aware that there was anywhere in Sumatra where they were available. And it's also a strange situation in that Indonesia has incredibly strict anti-drug laws. And I found out when I was in this tiny little island, which is at the northernmost part of Indonesia, it's called Pulauwei, that they're readily available on this little island, Samosir Island, in the middle of the largest volcanic lake in the world, Lake Toba. And when I got there, it was hilarious because you're walking down these peaceful streets in the middle of this volcanic lake, and there are signs on the guest houses that are advertising things like laundry, renting scooters, and magic mushrooms.
So, they really just said, I thought this was, you were going to tell me it was a front for the magic mushrooms, but it really just advertises it right there.
Yeah. So there's this little niche there where it's legal to grow them and to use them. And so lots of the locals do and have been doing so as part of their culture for a long time. And while I was traveling from Aceh, so up near Pulauwei, to Lake Toba, I met a guy who was interested in taking them too. And since I was staying in this beautiful spot by the lake, I just thought, well, I feel like I understand enough about these substances to use them in a rational way. I've got somebody else with me who I haven't known for long, but he seems like a good guy and I'm happy to put my trust in him. So I took what was probably quite a large dose of some of their local mushrooms, guessing it was something like 60 grams of fresh mushrooms, and split the dose in two. I had 2/3 at about 9 and then a third about an hour later, and just listened to music that I selected, which was quite interesting because how I went about this obviously was entirely suboptimal. You should have a self-selected playlist of music that you like that has certain characteristics. And instead, I was using this guy's iPhone and having to log into it using his password between songs.
Oh, no.
Just after taking a large dose of mushrooms. But that in itself was intriguing just because I was cognitively intact enough that I could still remember his password and punch it in each time. And I didn't really know what to expect going into it in terms of the sensory experiences. So I was surprised by how lucid I could be. And then since then, I've had another experience, which was on a beach in Europe a couple of months later, and I took 20 grams of Hollandia truffles, So I lower dose and took those early, and I just basically lay under a pine tree and listened to a playlist I made, which is based on one used in a study of music and psychedelics by Mendel Kaelin, who I mentioned earlier. And then in terms of the actual experiences, if I focus on the acute effects, then the Sumatra trip was certainly one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. The other trip was beautiful, but more challenging. The dials on my senses in the Sumatra trip were turned up well above normal, and the world just takes on this amazing iridescent quality. And I had a little bit of visual distortion with my eyes open. I first noticed that when I was looking at myself in the mirror, my face warped so that I looked very old.
And oh, I've seen that before, yeah.
Yeah, it was around that time that I realized that I really needed to get outside. But I didn't experience any traumatic hallucinations. I think some people, before they take these substances, they half expect to have an encounter with a dragon or something. And the reality is that very rarely happens if you have your eyes open. However, if you have them closed for a long period, then you can start quite complex visual hallucinations, certainly. With my eyes closed, because I had to keep exposing myself to the world around me to cue the next song. Back then, I only had some quite simple but very colourful and beautiful morphing percepts with my eyes closed. And it was interesting because they respond to environmental inputs. So, for example, if I just held my hand over my closed eyes, then that would affect how much light is getting to my retina, and that would affect what I was seeing. In the second trip, I used an eye mask and the visualizations became much, much more complex. And there was one point where I was listening to a song. It's called Shamanic Dream. I think it's about a half hour long song. It's unusual, but typical of the types of music that they use in this type of research. But I felt like I was just hovering over a fast forwarded version of a construction of an entire desert civilization over many centuries. And it sounds bizarre, but as we'll get to later, it was quite dreamlike in some ways. Some other things that I noticed include being much more attuned to sounds. So the sound of birds, for instance, was much louder, more vivid than normal. And music takes on this incredible three-dimensional quality that's quite hard to describe, but there's a real sense of depth to it. And I also got some synesthesia, which is quite common to a lot of people. So, for example, in the second trip, I was listening to a song named Azure by Greg Haynes, and there's this flickering sound. And as that sound flickered, it's like I could feel raindrops falling across the entire surface of my body. It's a really pleasurable but very abnormal experience. And then obviously had incredibly intense emotions, which were largely positive, so really deep feelings of love, but at times incredibly challenging too, and sometimes in quite unexpected ways. I had a strange sensation at my skin that I hadn't heard discussed previously, and I'm curious about whether you've experienced this, Chris, but my skin was very flushed, and the thing that I would liken it to is a bit like getting a pump at the gym, but more pleasurable. And certainly my sense of touch generally was heightened. It's, again, it's a little bit hard to describe. If you can imagine like the skin across your whole body is almost as sensitive as the skin is in your private parts. It's kind of almost like that. And then it did experience that sense of unity that's common to people's descriptions. And I also felt like the plants around me took on a life of their own. It was like I could see the characters of individual trees, which makes me sound like a dirt worshipping hippie. But it is interesting. I felt an enormous sense of gratitude to plants as well as to other humans and animals. And at times the whole thing was almost overwhelming, but it wasn't. And I think it wasn't because in both instances, I was in places that are quite serene and I had some control over various different environmental inputs. I didn't always. So for example, about 2 hours into the first trip, I got licked by a dog when I had my eyes closed. And that was like getting mauled by a grizzly bear. It was the most intense experience, but I just burst into laughter straight after that, obviously. But I didn't get all of the characteristics of the mystical experience that I mentioned that's so often described in research. So I didn't find it truly ineffable. I think that the experiences can be described. It's just hard finding the right words. It didn't feel like I fully transcended space and time. And I also don't think that I experienced the complete ego dissolution that many people describe. which could relate to dose, but I also think that it relates to the fact that in the first trip, I had my eyes open, I was sat with someone else, and I was messing around with the music and so on. Whereas if I'd been there with a blindfold on and I had a good playlist, I think the dose was certainly sufficient to lead to that type of experience. I also didn't get that noetic quality, that sense of encountering the ultimate truth. But what I did notice afterwards, and this is true of both trips, is the afterglow phenomenon. I just felt noticeably more mindful, probably for a month or so after. A bit more positive, a little bit less anxious. I felt more connected to other people, deeper feelings of empathy and compassion. And I also noticed that it certainly rekindled my love of music. I used to spend hours and hours listening to music, mixing electronic music, downloading it, messing around with it. And I think in recent years, since I've been busy with work, I haven't spent as much time on that, but I now listen to music a lot more than I used to. And then out of curiosity, I also took some validated psychometric tests a day before the trip on the beach and then a month after it. And I found that my scores in many different scales improved. So I looked at the state trait anxiety inventory, the Warwick Edinburgh mental well-being scale. And interestingly, I've had insomnia symptoms from time to time over the years, and I've had very few since my first trip, which is curious, and we'll get to that later, but I think there might be something going on there. And obviously, all of that could just be placebo, but it could also be some of the integration work that I tried to do, but that was really self-directed. And I think a lot of it is actually to do with the substances themselves.
Well, so, tell us more about the integration. No, I don't mind saying something, but tell us more about the integration work. That word to me is somewhat confusing. What exactly do you mean by integration, and what did you do?
Yeah, it is confusing, and the research on integration is minimal, but I mostly carried on my usual meditation practice, which I've had for years, but I also tuned it in certain ways. In particular, I increased the amount of loving kindness meditation that I was doing. Again, sounds quite woo, but certainly can be helpful in promoting mental well-being, increasing feelings of compassion, and so on. I did a lot of diarizing around both trips, both recording the contents of the trips, which was interesting because I felt like I could remember them all start to finish. And I know that's not the case with some psychedelics, certainly taken at high doses, but I really didn't feel dissociated or so cognitively impaired that I couldn't recall the details in chronological order. And I also kept a gratitude diary, which again is something that I've used a little bit over the years, but basically a variety of different things all centered on increasing feelings of compassion and appreciation, but also making sure that I document the experience so that I have on record what struck me as being profound and what I like to take from the trips going forward.
Is there a way for you to, do you know how much of the psilocybin you took? Is this like too much of a reductionistic approach to understanding psychedelics? But you mentioned there the 60 grams of fresh mushrooms and then later 20 grams of truffles. Have you any idea how much of the psilocybin you took? Because that's that when you read a study on magic mushrooms, I know you're not supposed to say that, but that's what they are. They're not taking any of those things, right? Like it's an isolated drug-like compound.
Yeah, exactly. So it's always pure psilocybin in the case of truffles and mushrooms. And the dose is normally 20 to 30 milligrams. And I think that the truffles probably contained about 20 milligrams of psilocybin, and the fresh mushrooms probably contained substantially more than that, and probably more than 30 milligrams too. One of the interesting things that hasn't been well studied, unsurprisingly, is whether there are truly entourage effects. The idea is that if you look at the chemical composition of magic mushrooms, there are many different chemicals in there, lots of different substances, some of which could be psychedelic. So, for example, there's also psilocin in there, which is what psilocybin is ultimately metabolized to, and it's what exerts its psychoactive effects. And so it could be that in the case of mushrooms or truffles, you actually need a lower amount of psilocybin from them in conjunction with some of these other chemicals to get the equivalent experience of a higher dose of purified psilocybin. And some people who have tried both say that the experiences are somewhat different. And not having tried synthesized psilocybin, I can't really comment on that. But I think more work needs to be done for sure. And also, just related to what I was just saying, one of the issues in this type of research is that people do use different forms of these drugs. It's not like there's one type of psilocybin that's always used. And nowadays, lots of companies have turned up and they're trying to make their own patented forms of these drugs so that they can make billions of dollars down the line. In the case of LSD, also comes as a pure base or as a salt. So LSD tartrate is often used. And when you look at some of those studies, it can be confusing because a study might say that the participants received 200 micrograms of LSD, but they actually received 200 micrograms of LSD tartrate, which contains less LSD than that. And that might explain some of the discrepancies between some of these studies. And so it is important going forward to start to get into the details of the substances that have been used and think about whether there are better forms than others of them. And just given my disposition, I was really keen to try this psychedelic that's found in the natural world in its natural form and see what the experience is that people have been having for thousands of years.
Yeah, just the exploration of altered states of consciousness, I think, is a worthy intention. You know, it's definitely something that I think that I hope that everyone has the opportunity to explore at some point. You said something earlier. Do you think there's a connection between what you described as synesthesia and the modularity of the brain? Like, I do wonder that, like, is there like one compartment that deals with one thing and another compartment that deals with another? And suddenly those compartments are broken down and now all of a sudden you can see music. Or, you know, my thing was like, you can like physically tactile feel an emotion. Do you think there's a connection between those two things, or am I just hallucinating that?
Well, I think Anil Seth would say that you're hallucinating consciousness all the time, I think. But
it's true, actually. It's just that we all agree. It's like, it's the same hallucination we're all having, unless you're schizophrenic or you're taking mushrooms or something else that I probably don't understand.
Yeah, borderline personality disorder or something. Yeah. I think that's exactly what's going on. And again, it's not something that's that well understood, the neurobiology of it, and there are all sorts of technical difficulties in trying to get to those mechanisms. But I think it's that increased crosstalk between some of these different cortices that accounts for synesthesia. So if your visual cortex is now communicating differently with parts of the brain that are involved in feelings of touch, for instance, then maybe that helps explain why when I listen to Azure, feel those sounds rippling across my skin.
Yeah. And, you know, you're making me wonder about the different types of cognition. You know, I've read a fair amount of developmental psychology, and something that comes up a lot is the difference between the spotlight of attention and a lantern-like consciousness that's characteristic of early childhood. And I can't help wondering if the psilocybin returns you to that more childlike cognition where you're paying attention to all of the things all of the time. And it's almost impossible to focus on anything, right? So yeah, hearing the birds cheeping whilst you just stood there, like someone's talking to you and you're hearing them talking, but you're also hearing the birds in the background. Like, what's going on with that? And yeah, it's not just sound. It's also, I noticed with touch as well. So I'll be walking on a trail in the woods and I can really feel like the ground underneath my feet. What's going on with that? Like, it's always there. It's just that I'm not paying attention to it normally.
Yeah, we might return to the change in sensory experiences and sensory processing in the brain when we talk about dreams a little bit later, because there are some parallels there. But you mentioned some of your own experience there, Chris. I'm curious about your experience too, because I know that you dabbled with some of these too in recent times.
I have dabbled a little bit, and I don't want to go on about it because I don't think I have anything to say that's particularly useful for anyone else. You know, that's the reason I wanted to get you on to talk about it, was because, you know, you've used this word ineffable more than once now, but is that that just most people lack the vocabulary to describe the experience, you know, like use that word noetic. Like, that's a new word to me. I never heard that word before, you know, like, so maybe that's why it's ineffable to me. But yet, no, I have dabbled in various different forms and settings. I've done mostly what I would describe as sort of light recreational. And I've taken a liquid preparation in an ethanol. Who knows how much psilocybin is in that? You know, I just don't know. And also dried mushrooms that I've taken both encapsulated, which is a total waste of time, by the way. Like, the mushrooms don't taste bad. You can just eat them. Like, they don't taste that bad. They taste like mushrooms is what they taste like, even when they're dried. You don't need to encapsulate them. I learned that. And, you know, I did one trip that was way more intentional. I actually traveled from, you know, where I live to another place. And I think that's important, the setting, like drawing a line underneath your normal daily activities and making this a thing that you do and only that you do. And then I took a super high dose that was maybe equivalent to 7 grams of dried mushrooms. So that's, you know, what you might call a heroic dose. Although, again, I don't really know because I don't know how much is in these bottles, right? And I wore an eye mask and I listened to music, and I had a friend who really knows her stuff prepare that music. And it felt to me like she was the conductor of the entire experience. It was really strange. And I did have the types of experience that you said that you didn't. So I think what generally happens when you put on an eye mask is the experience very much turns inwards, you know, where I could spend the whole day just staring at this fern in my redwood forest garden, right, and have a really good time for 5 hours. But I'm not sure that I would make that much progress in the personal development space, right? Like, I don't think that would be terribly helpful there. So the eye mask, it makes the whole thing turn inwards. And I can't really describe it anymore. I didn't really have a physical body. I was just completely gone. And it felt like I was flying through space. But then that sentence doesn't make any sense because who is I? You know, like, it was really a very different experience, a very good one. All of my experiences have been good. It's just wave after wave of love and gratitude and joy. And, you know, I think about my kids and I start crying. And yeah, it's obvious to see how there could be a potential antidepressant effect here, right? Like, if you did, and it's not like you're talking about doing this on a, you know, a daily basis or even a weekly basis, like just this once a quarter, like I can totally see the potential. So that's why I hope that everyone has the opportunity to try it at some point. I think the most helpful thing that someone said to me prior to my first experience was this idea of relaxing your priors. So this is a technical, maybe they know me well enough to talk to me in computer science words, you know, from Bayesian logic. And this idea of a prior is something that you believe about the world. And psilocybin especially, I think it has this ability to relax your priors. So, you know, maybe as a small child, you learned that when a ball rolls off a desk, it falls down and not up. And when, you know, you tap on the wall, it's hard and your hand doesn't go through it. And when you lie on the floor and look at the grain in the hardwood floor, it stays stationary, right? Even though it does kind of look like it might be flowing, but captured in a snapshot of time. All of those priors are relaxed. And so that's why, you know, the walls look like they're breathing. And, you know, like, maybe this is what was a hard surface now looks soft. Like, I think that was quite a helpful thing for someone to say to me. And I think it's true of, like, you know, what you said about the ski tracks, right? Like, everything you think you know about the world, just for a moment, temporarily, that's relaxed somewhat and it allows you to think about old problems in new ways. And that, again, I think that rigidity that you mentioned earlier, just relaxing that just a little bit, I think is really helpful.
Yeah. It's interesting also that terminology, relaxing your priors, because I think that's actually used in some of the neuroscientific literature.
Oh, it is?
On psychedelics. Yeah, I think that's something that the likes of Carhart Harris and Carl Friston have written about previously. And the importance of that in certain psychopathological states in particular, because what can happen is this kind of canalization in which people get stuck in their tracks. And by relaxing their priors, they open themselves to new ways of thinking and behaving. And then they can hopefully get out of those deep tracks that are taking them in the wrong direction.
Yeah, Carl Friston's free energy principle is something I'd encourage anybody listening to this to, like, lose yourself on the internet for an afternoon. I think you learn a lot about the way that Friston believes that the brain works, right? It's this unified theory of everything, that the brain is a statistical organ and it's making inferences about the input on the sensorium. So this goes back to what we said earlier. It's all a hallucination, right? It's just that generally we have the same shared hallucination. I think, yeah. So what is it that the psychedelics are doing? I sometimes wonder whether they're just neurotoxins, right? Like, they just mess with the brain's ability to make inferences given the input on the sensorium. Like, has anyone considered that? Like, it's not like the mushroom's trying to help us. It's just a toxin like other mushrooms are toxic. It's just that it's a particular type of toxin that works in a very specific way.
Yeah, it's interesting. And also, I think actually exactly how those chemicals are acting on their targets in the brain is somewhat mysterious. There seem to be some quite large unsolved questions in relation to that. So I'm thinking in particular of that paper that I mentioned earlier that was just published in Science recently, suggesting that it is acting on the serotonin 2A receptors that is leading to neuroplasticity down the line. But interestingly, it's not necessarily serotonin that's doing that. And in that study, I think they found that was true of psilocin and DMT, but I haven't had the chance to read the full text yet. However, I know that they were alluding to the fact that they really don't actually understand exactly how that's going on. But yeah, in terms of plant defense chemicals and so on, maybe that's some of it. I think there are also some competing hypotheses suggesting that it's some form of symbiosis that's contributed to humans' abilities to thrive and work together in communities and so on. And so maybe there could be some sort of symbiosis there, but I'm not familiar enough with those ideas to be able to speak about them coherently.
So shall we talk a bit about psychedelics and sleep? Do you want to talk about how psychedelics affect sleep architecture? I think perhaps one really basic thing that I might mention from my own experiences is that psilocybin does not affect my sleep if I take it early enough in the day. I had not taken psilocybin or magic mushrooms as a young adult, and I did take some other drugs, and they definitely mess with my sleep. Not sure that it was the drug per se that was messing with my sleep, but rather other things like going to a nightclub, staying up till 6 in the morning, 5 pints of strong lager. There was like many co-founders. And at this point, for both the mushrooms and MDMA, I'm certain it's not, the drug alone is not, you know, like sufficient, you know, to mess with my sleep. And after mushrooms and MDMA I did recently, I slept like a baby that night. It was absolutely fine. But I started really early, like, you know, sometime in the late morning rather than, you know, like at midnight or something like that. I think that's important. But I think your experience has been the same. Maybe you want to say something about that. And then do you want to talk about how psychedelics affect sleep architecture?
Yeah, sure. And just to pick up on what you just said, posted something recently about some of David Nutt's work on MDMA specifically, because people have always spoken about Blue Mondays. They go out on the weekend, they take some MD while they're at a club, they have a great time. And the idea historically has been that leads to some sort of depressant action in the days that follow. And his recent work suggests that's just not the case. So if people do feel miserable on Monday mornings, then it's surely the sleep loss and the circadian disruption and the 14 pints of beer.
It's just ridiculous when you think about it.
A little bit. But yeah, I will touch on sleep architecture because, similar to you, Chris, my personal experience is that acutely there's no obvious effect on sleep architecture. It's not like your sleep is dramatically different. I think if you took 30 milligrams of psilocybin half an hour before you're due to go to bed, then your sleep would definitely be different because they are stimulatory. However, taken early in the day, I see no reasons to why they would strongly affect their sleep.
True of MDMA, right? Because MDMA is a methamphetamine that definitely is doing something different from the mushrooms, right? Like it's very hard for me to sit still after I've taken MDMA, even if there's no music or dancing or anything.
Sure. And that raises an important point, which is that classic psychedelics, so if you put MDMA to the side, they're not all alike in their pharmacological properties. So LSD, for instance, is somewhat dopaminergic too, which probably explains why if you take 20 micrograms of it as a microdose, you might experience a slight increase in feelings of agitation and energy and so on, which in some ways might feel somewhat similar to caffeine, whereas psilocybin isn't as activating in that way. But regarding sleep, it probably makes a little bit of sense just to get into some of the neurobiology of this, just because the chemical changes that take place in your brain contribute to your sleep architecture. And we know that, generally speaking, monoamine, so serotonin, noradrenaline, dopamine, they generally block entry into REM sleep. And during REM sleep, serotonergic activity is low and acetylcholinergic signaling in the brainstem is high. And classic psychedelics obviously are very strongly serotonergic. And so people have hypothesized that serotonergic psychedelics, similar to most antidepressants, almost all other antidepressants, so SSRIs and so on, will reduce REM sleep and also lead people to take longer to get into REM sleep. They'll prolong REM sleep latency. And this is all quite interesting because if you look at sleep architecture changes in people who have depression, there are some characteristic changes, in particular in their rapid eye movement sleep. So in something like 50 to 70% of these people, there's disinhibition of REM sleep. So they enter REM sleep sooner and they have a longer first REM sleep period. they have more REM sleep in total. And interestingly, they have higher REM sleep density, and that just refers to the number of these characteristic side-to-side eye movements that take place during REM sleep, especially at the start of the night. And if you look at people who have depression versus people who don't have it, then it seems to be that swift entry to REM sleep and the density of those eye movements that best discriminates depression from people who don't have that particular mental health disorder. And interestingly, as people's depression symptoms change over time, they also seem to move in lockstep with some of these changes in REM sleep. And so I think there are some genuine therapeutic considerations here. But you also see some other changes in depression. So sometimes, for instance, you see impaired sleep continuity. So you might see more frequent awakenings. Some people wake up very early in the morning. Some people also have less slow wave sleep, which is the deeper stage of sleep. The picture's a little bit complicated just because the sleep changes tend to change over time. So for instance, insomnia often precedes depression. And in insomnia, it's often that rapid eye movement sleep is more broken up. But what can happen is that while during that initial period, people actually might lose a bit of REM sleep, there's then this REM rebound that contributes to depression. And so by changing sleep architecture, it could be that psychedelics are helping people either treat depression or avoid depression in the first place. But if we just focus briefly on a couple of studies that have been done looking at the effects of psychedelics on sleep architecture, then there's some really old research on LSD. I haven't been able to read the original research. It actually suggested that LSD might increase REM sleep, which is contrary to what you would expect. The more recent work on psilocybin and ayahuasca, suggests the opposite.
You've got that on the brain, haven't you? You've spent a lot of time thinking about ashwagandha.
I spent too long speaking about ashwagandha too. But probably the most relevant study was done in 2020 by some scientists in the Czech Republic. And they basically just took some adults and they randomized them into a placebo group or a psilocybin group. The dose of the psilocybin was adjusted according to body weight, but for an 80 kilo person, the dose was about 20 milligrams, just to give you an idea of the dose. So it's a substantial dose, but it's not a heroic dose. And they looked at the change in sleep architecture and also some subjective sleep measures. And they took that dose that I mentioned at 9 a.m. in the morning, so quite far from sleep, and therefore you wouldn't expect there to be strong effects on sleep necessarily. Interestingly, there are some differences between what the scientists reported and in the abstract of the study, that is, how I would interpret their results. So the abstract focuses on rapid eye movement sleep, which you would expect based on what I was just saying about depression and REM sleep. But while they said that there was prolonged REM sleep latency, so people were taking longer to get into REM sleep, that was based on an uncorrected one-tailed test, and the effect size was tiny and it was barely significant. So it's not exactly a solid finding. And the other claim made is reduced REM sleep duration, but that wasn't even statistically significant. And again, it was subject to those same issues that I just mentioned. They also noted that psilocybin reduced slow wave activity, which is typical of deep sleep, at the start of the night. And that's been found for some other antidepressants. And they claim no other changes in non-rapid eye movement sleep. However, again, when you look at the actual results, and this is using two-tailed tests this time, which are less likely to produce false positives, there was a trend to reduced N1 sleep, which is the lighter stage of sleep, and also slow wave sleep, the deeper stage. And that might be relevant because there are instances in which reducing slow wave sleep and slow wave activity can have some antidepressant effects. And then they also, as I mentioned, looked at some subjective change in their sleep. And they basically found that people felt like they entered sleep a little bit later after taking the drug. But clearly that study has some shortcomings, although it's a good first effort looking at psilocybin. The other study that's relevant was done a few years previously looking at ayahuasca, and they gave people a substantial dose of DMT. They used a positive control, which is interesting. So you mentioned MDMA, Chris, and how if you take a large dose of that, because it is so dopaminergic, it could affect your sleep. They used 20 milligrams of D-amphetamine as a positive control. So they had three arms in this. They had the ayahuasca, they had the amphetamine, and they had the placebo. And all of these were given at midday. And this time around, they found that ayahuasca didn't really affect how well people feel they slept, or how long it took people to fall asleep, or their sleep efficiency. Whereas the amphetamine, obviously, it caused people to take longer to fall asleep, and it disrupted their sleep, and it lightened their sleep, and it worsened how well they feel they slept. But interestingly, ayahuasca did reduce rapid eye movement sleep and tended to cause people to enter it later, which is congruent with those findings on psilocybin that I mentioned earlier. And both of these studies were done on healthy people, so it'd be interesting to see whether the results might be a little different if you looked at people who have various different mental health disorders, such as depression. But to summarize those studies, it seems that people are probably taking a little bit longer to get into rapid eye movement sleep after taking psychedelics. Rapid eye movement sleep might be occupying a little bit less of their sleep as well. And it's plausible that those changes could contribute to some of their antidepressant properties.
And having seen a lot of sleep studies, would you say that these changes are within normal variation? It seems like there's lots of things that can impact sleep. In fact, we know they are because you've talked about them on the podcast. Is it possible that these are just within normal variation?
Statistically, I don't think they are. But also, these aren't large effect sizes. And I actually think that if there is magic to the effects of psychedelics on sleep, or if psychedelics are exerting some of their magic by changing people's sleep, then it might be through some indirect pathways. Maybe we'll come back to that later. But if, for instance, people are better able to behave in ways that support their sleep health after taking psychedelics, then that could be one route by which the psychedelics are improving people's sleep. Or if people are more accepting of unhelpful thoughts, or if they have fewer maladaptive thoughts afterwards, and their mood is better, and their pre-sleep mood is higher, and they're less anxious before getting to bed, then again, I think all of those things could positively affect their sleep.
Earlier, we chatted about the similarities between psychedelics and REM sleep dreaming. Can you just quickly characterize and define REM sleep and REM sleep dreaming, just so that we're absolutely sure what you're talking about? You used that word REM a lot in that last answer, and I just want to be absolutely sure that I understand what you're talking about.
Sure. Yeah. So sleep's broadly split into non-REM and REM. REM is so named because of those rapid eye movements that take place during it, in which the eyes move from side to side. And we cycle between these different stages of sleep over the course of night, and the proportion of rapid eye movement sleep increases over the course of the night, such that we tend to have most of it shortly before we wake in the morning. Interestingly, if you look at REM sleep in humans compared to other primates, we have less total sleep, a much higher proportion of REM sleep than other primates, which suggests that it might have had some important effects in our evolution and might have helped differentiate us in some ways. Speculative, but it's interesting. But there are some changes that take place in REM sleep that are very unlike other sleep states. So some of these are quite obvious. One of them is men get erections, or at least they should get erections. And you see similar changes in women's private parts during this stage too. You see large swings in breathing rate and heart rate during REM sleep, which is very much unlike non-REM sleep. There's also muscle paralysis, which presumably is so that you don't act out your dreams. There is actually a condition named REM sleep behavior disorder, in which that paralysis doesn't take place. And increasingly, it's associated with a remarkably higher increased risk of going on to develop certain neurodegenerative diseases in years to come, such as Parkinson's. But REM sleep is sometimes called paradoxical sleep because brain activity actually looks quite a lot like wakefulness in some ways. And going by blood flow in different parts of the brain, some parts of the brain seem to be slightly more active than they are during wakefulness. But in terms of the roles of REM sleep, it seems to be important to emotion regulation, which we'll come back to. And that might be relevant to those changes in REM sleep that you see in mood disorders that I touched on earlier. It's thought that it could be involved in the development of consciousness, which may help explain why we have so much of it early in life. If you look at a newborn, their sleep isn't split into stages the way that adult sleep is. And instead, we tend to speak about them having active sleep and passive sleep. But one of these more or less maps to REM sleep, and it occupies about 50% of their sleep when they're first born. And you might have noticed that if you've had kids, if you watch their eyelids while they're sleeping, you'll see their eyes rolling around in there. It's really sweet. But some other roles of REM sleep would be maybe helping people understand the general gist of questions. The way that I tend to describe this, I stole from Robert Stickgold, and it's that if you were doing a multiple choice questionnaire test, you'd want to get plenty of REM sleep before it, because you might not know the precise answer, but if you've got a strong intuition as to what the question is getting at, then you're more likely to select the right one. And in that context, I think REM sleep is likely to be especially helpful. It also might have some involvement in motor learning. There's some early work on cats by Juve suggesting that to be true. And then, as we've touched on, we have our most vivid dreams in REM sleep. And we actually probably dream most of the time that we're asleep, maybe something like 3/4 of the time. But we have our most weird and irrational ones during REM sleep. And there are probably a few things that explain that. One of them is the part of the brain that's involved in rational decision making goes offline. Another is that you also see a strong increase in activity in parts of the brainstem. And actually, this is at the core of some of the models of dreaming that have been put forward. The most popular of the post-Freudian of these was Hobson's activation synthesis model, which was put forward in the 70s. And he basically suggested that dreams result from this more or less random occasional activation of these brainstem structures. And that's the activation part of activation synthesis. And then afterwards, the brain tries to make sense of the results. It synthesizes these different things that are cropping up into some sort of semi-coherent dream narrative. But more recently, of course, people have come up with other theories of dreaming. And one that we've spoken about briefly previously, Chris, is Robert Stickgold's Next Up model. That stands for network exploration to understand possibilities. And the idea here is that dreaming extracts new knowledge from existing information, and it does so by discovering and strengthening previously unexplored associations between, for example, distant autobiographical memories and more recent memories. And the other thing that I'll just touch on here is lucid dreaming, just because there are some really interesting parallels between that and the psychedelic state. And lucid dreams are just dreams in which a person is aware that he or she is dreaming, regardless of whether it's possible to control the dreams. And roughly half of people will have had lucid dreams at some point. And it's also somewhat trainable. If you've had a lucid dream, you can train yourself to have them more frequently. Whether you should is a different story.
I have read When Brains Dream by Robert Stickgold. It's very good, well worth a read. He also has some short videos online that I'd recommend. Maybe we could link to a couple of those in the show notes for this episode that you can find over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcasts. I think there's a TEDx talk, if I recall correctly. You said something interesting there, Greg, which is the part of the brain involved in rational decision-making is offline during REM sleep. And I wonder if that is also true of altered states of cognition caused by psychedelics, right? I feel like the same thing is going on, you know, like there's this exploration of ideas, and you know, the part of the brain that says, no, that's a terrible idea, is currently offline. And so that leads to the wildness and wackiness of dreams. And I often find that when I wake up, I want to go and do something. And then before my feet have really got out of bed, I'm like, oh, that's a terrible idea. What was I thinking? But then the same is true in the psychedelic state. And I think this is also like, it leads to, like, for me, a slight paranoia whilst on mushrooms, especially if I do something like go for a walk in the woods. Like, I'm afraid that I'm going to get lost, even though that's completely ridiculous. If I was totally sober, then there's no way I'm getting lost. And it seems to be like almost like a rumination, you know, like the same thought is coming up over and over again. It's like maybe something's been generated from the fear center of the brain. And then the professor is just like not adequately examining and processing the threat. And so it just keeps coming up and up and over again. But what do you think? There's a comparison between the psychedelic state and REM sleep?
Yeah, well, I think there are lots of comparisons, but just to touch on some of the things that you said. So one of them was the idea that this part of the brain that's very important to rational decision making, which is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, largely goes offline during dreams. And that probably helps explain why we uncritically accept weird experiences that take place during dreams. And I think there are probably ways in which that's adaptive. Of course there are, because otherwise that brain state wouldn't have evolved. But I think it's really leading to more flexible cognitive processing than is present during other sleep stages or during wakefulness. So because this rational part of the brain isn't constraining mental associations and emotions as much in this sleep stage, it could be that dreaming helps us come up with creative solutions to problems. And actually, going back to Robert Stickgold, he's done some work showing that people are more likely to solve anagrams if you wake them up from rapid eye movement sleep and then ask them to come up with a solution than if you wake them up from non-rapid eye movement sleep. So I think there is surely a purpose of those changes that take place. And then under the influence of psychedelics, certainly high doses of psychedelics tend to impair certain cognitive functions. So things like your ability to pay attention, how well you can remember where things are located. And that seems to relate to reduced activity in that dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and changes in its connectivity too. And I think if you look at lower doses of psychedelics, so there's been some work, for instance, on a mini dose of LSD, 50 micrograms, then that can actually be helpful. So it's been shown to improve people's ability to think in novel ways and to do so in ways that somewhat parallel the effects of rapid eye movement sleep. So I think there are probably some parallels there, but then you also spoke a little bit about emotional processing. And that is certainly something that both have been shown to be important too. And I think some of this relates to what's called fear extinction. And basically the idea is that over time we learn to fear certain things through conditioning. And what we can do is we can learn to reduce these fear condition responses if we expose ourselves to things that we've previously learned to fear, but do so in safer environments. And during dreaming, parts of the brain are involved in storing and processing those negative memories that I mentioned earlier. So those brainstem structures like the amygdala, they get activated. So they re-expose us to these things that we fear. But in the dreaming state, this time they're reactivated in isolated ways that are dissociated from their real world context, and they get combined in novel ways with other visualizations into this dream narrative. And I think it's through that that we can help better process these emotions, because what we're really doing is exposing ourselves to these fear conditioned stimuli in a safe simulation of the world. And then related to this, under psychedelics, there's also increased emotional memory activation. Sometimes people will recall things that they haven't thought about for years. And there's heightened intensity of emotions too, but that heightened emotional intensity is generally positive. And it also takes place alongside increased neuroplasticity. And again, there's no threatening stimulus present necessarily. So maybe once more, that's helping us to process these fearful memories. And that's probably more likely to take place if you're in a supportive environment. So if you're there with a trained psychotherapist, for instance. And just as a tangent, I think this is probably one of the reasons why MDMA is so helpful in PTSD. It lets people re-experience and work through challenging memories, but in a neurochemical environment that means that they can think about things that have been exceptionally difficult for them, but while actually still experiencing broadly positive states.
Oh, they're still lucid, right? You can still talk to them. You can't really do that when you're on mushrooms. It's true. And you're reminding me, I interviewed my friend and colleague, Jason Connell, a couple of times for the podcast, and he talked about accelerated experiential dynamic psychotherapy, ADP. And that's what you're talking about, like the experiential part of the psychotherapy. That's exactly what you've just described. And my wife and co-founder, Julie, worked with him for a while and found it tremendously beneficial. And then she was done. Like, you quite often don't hear about that in therapy, right? Like you do, you know, like a fixed number of sessions, and then you feel like you've achieved everything you set out to accomplish, and that's it, and you move on with your life. Usually it seems to feel like this ongoing thing, and maybe that's not bad, but it's, I don't know, it can get expensive.
But yeah, no, I think their use can really catalyze many different types of interventions, and there are big questions remaining as to what the best combinations of these different interventions are. So just returning to the idea of integration, we really don't know that much about the components of integration that are most important and which are indicated in different circumstances, depending on somebody's mental health struggles, depending on someone's level of education, whatever it might be. So how can we take a modular approach to combining these different things in a way that makes sense and helps people make the most progress possible in the shortest amount of time while spending the least cash?
Yeah, Jason was adamant that he could get the same or better results than, say, with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. But maybe the MDMA turns any garden variety therapist into a Jason, right? Like he was literally a magician. Like he is quite an extraordinary individual. And I'm not surprised he gets outstanding results, given what I know about his history. But maybe that's somewhat unique. And the drug, it sort of levels the playing field a bit. And it's like a sort of a prosthesis for a therapist.
His business is threatened. I also just as a another tangent. I think it's really interesting to consider how we might be able to combine some of these different substances. And there really hasn't been much work on this, but I know that Matthias Leichty has some work ongoing looking at the combination of LSD with MDMA. So I think that he's got a multiple arm study. And one of the groups, if I recall correctly, is 100 micrograms of LSD with 100 milligrams of MDMA. And the idea here is that one of the issues, especially with very high doses of LSD, so if you took 200 to 250 micrograms of LSD, at a high dose like that, there is a real probability of you experiencing some bad drug effects, or what most people would refer to as a bad trip. And if you take a slightly lower dose and you combine that with MDMA, which almost without fail leads to this incredibly positively valenced suite of emotions, then maybe you're going to reduce the likelihood of experiencing that bad trip, still get the plasticity afforded by the LSD, and basically end up with something that's the best of both. And I'm not recommending that at the moment, but I just think that that's actually a fascinating approach that might have real legs.
Based on their adaptive effects, do you think that psychedelics will be a helpful adjunct to other interventions?
Yeah, I think they're probably going to help with lots of different types of interventions. And they're probably most likely to help with any instance in which psychological rigidity is a problem, or someone is likely to benefit from increased neuroplasticity. So obviously, this is all very relevant to many different forms of psychopathology. Touch on some of those: depression, anxiety, things like OCD as well, I think. OCPD, obsessive compulsive personality disorder. All of those are characterized by rigidity in ways of acting and thinking. And I think there are several examples of using psychedelics as an adjunct that are really interesting. So some of these have looked at mindfulness practices specifically. And I read a nice review quite recently by a guy named Jake Payne, and he put forward an analogy in which taking psychedelics is a bit like using a compass. So it's helpful for initiating changes, providing motivation, steering someone's course. But then meditation is a bit like the vehicle that you can then use to actually get to your destination, or to go about the journey in a way that makes things as enjoyable as possible. So it's important to integrating your experiences and to deepening what you've learned, and also learning how to generalize those lessons in your life in general. And I'm thinking in particular of a couple of studies. So one of them was done by Roland Griffiths, and he did this spiritual practice study in which he split people into three groups. One of them had a low dose of psilocybin with standard support, what they called standard support. So over the course of the whole study, these people had about 7.5 hours of contact time with the researchers. Another group had a high dose. So they actually had two high doses. One was 20 milligrams and one was 30 milligrams of psilocybin with standard support. So the same level of support as the first group. But then the other group was that same series of two high doses, but with lots of support from the researchers. And the spiritual practice included meditation, journaling, and some focused attention training, which is something that you can do to help improve your ability to pay attention to different tasks. And the people took the psilocybin 1 month and 2 months after starting with their spiritual practices. And it was double blind, so neither the participants nor the researchers knew what was going on. But what they found was that compared with that low dose intervention, the high dose produced greater effects both in the short term and over time as well. And 4 months after the second dose, if you compare these people with the low dose intervention, both high dose groups had large positive changes in feelings of closeness with other people, gratitude, life meaning, daily spiritual experiences, religious faith for people who were that way inclined. And interestingly, they actually had third parties provide ratings of these people too. So they said what their perceptions of them were and whether they changed over time. And these feelings that the people who'd taken the drugs reported were backed up by these third party observers too. And interestingly, it was those mystical experiences that largely explained the effects. So while psilocybin didn't actually improve adherence with the practices, they still needed some support. There was certainly an indication that combination can be really helpful. There was also some work on expert meditators in which in the middle of a 5-day mindfulness retreat, they gave people a high dose of psilocybin. And this was during meditation practice. And they found that in the short term, these people actually achieved incredible depth in their meditation and experienced the kind of ego dissolution that is typical of high doses of these drugs. But interestingly, I think this is probably in part because these people were expert meditators. They didn't really experience any anxiety. And they followed them up over time. And they found that compared with people who took a placebo, the psilocybin actually enhanced their mindfulness practice. And 4 months afterwards, various different changes in psychosocial functioning were much higher. And again, these subjective responses were backed up by third-party observers. So I think meditation seems to enhance some of psilocybin's positive effects. And it also might actually help people with difficult experiences that arise during trips. I know you haven't had one of those, Chris, but if somebody does have a bad trip, then I think just being able to take lessons that have been learned during meditation, apply those in real time, can really help people to better cope with some of those experiences. But then obviously related to mindfulness, there are various different therapies. There's acceptance and commitment therapy. I know that you guys have used that quite a lot at MBT. It can be really helpful. And that incorporates many elements of different mindfulness practices, and it helps people identify their values. And I think going by that analogy in the paper that I mentioned earlier, the idea that psychedelics can provide a kind of compass, I just see psychedelics being a very nice complement to ACT. There's sleep as well. So we glossed over this earlier, but if you think about cognitive behavioral therapies for insomnia or different metacognitive interventions, so mindfulness-based stress reduction, maybe combined with some elements of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, I think those plus psychedelics are really interesting to study. And to my knowledge, there's no work on this that's being done yet.
Wow.
So I think
that's crazy.
It could be that psychedelics are going to indirectly benefit sleep in those ways that I mentioned earlier, so reducing anxiety and so on, but also might help, especially with some of those cognitive therapies that help people address those unhelpful sleep-related thoughts and anxieties. My guess is Sorry, Chris, go for it.
I was just going to say, one would have thought, though, that psychedelics are hard to study because of all these confounders and placebo effects. Like you just mentioned there, that you know, people meditating were either given a high dose of psilocybin or a placebo. I think they're going to know, right? Like, there's no active placebo there, right? Like, you give, I know I've heard, you know, haven't I heard about niacin being used as an active placebo?
Yeah.
In psych- I think I would know, like that. A little bit of a tingle, yeah. Versus the magic mushrooms. And then also, you know, we've done a podcast on microdosing psychedelics, and it would seem there's really nothing there other than people who microdose have found a way to harness the power of the placebo, right? Like, that in itself is like a very interesting thing. But yeah.
So the microdosing podcast that you did, that was with one of the scientists from Imperial, wasn't it? And it was the self-blinding study that was published in eLife.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is interesting, because did that focus on psilocybin specifically?
No, it was mostly LSD, I believe, because LSD is, you know, active in the microgram range, if I'm not mistaken. You can put it on like a blot on a tiny piece of paper and then put that in a capsule, and you wouldn't know, like, it's still so light, you wouldn't know whether it's an empty capsule or not. You can't really do that with mushrooms, as I understand it.
Because a lot of the research that's come out in recent times does suggest some small effects from LSD microdosing, specifically taking something in the range of roughly 15 to 25 micrograms. And if you look at work by people such as Harriet DeWitt, which is done under incredibly tightly controlled conditions, obviously placebo controlled too, I think there are some changes that do take place when you get to roughly 20 micrograms or so. But like you say, there are just these enormous issues with studying psychedelics that apply across all of these different types of research projects. So there are really strong expectancy effects, and people really want to try these drugs. They want to try them so much that there are many studies that make sure that everyone has at least one dose at some point. That's the only way that they can get people to sign up to the studies, because they'd be so disappointed otherwise. And like you say, I think niacin is just a rubbish placebo, because you might get a bit of a flash from taking niacin, but it's not exactly the same as taking 30 milligrams of psilocybin. But sometimes they use a positive control. So I mentioned that they use dextroamphetamine in some studies. So I don't think that there are good solutions to those issues. I think people.
Well, I think that Josh Turtnet has been very good on this with, you know, so the randomized control trial is one way to acquire knowledge. But of course, there are others, you know, in, you know, when you're building software, you're not using a randomized control trial to figure out what works. You're using validated learning. That is, you know, you take some action, you get some objective feedback, and then you make a decision. You repeat the cycle, right? Like, and the tighter the cycle, the better. You know, so maybe that's the way that we acquire knowledge with psychedelics. It's not the randomized control trial.
Yeah, and this isn't so relevant to psychedelics necessarily, but I do think that certain types of studies, so I know some people speak about things like sequential multiple assignment randomized trials, are really interesting, because what you can do is you can basically start with something that looks a little bit like a traditional RCT, where you split people into groups or you start people on an intervention, but then at some point you measure how they're getting on, and some of them will be responding favorably and others won't be. And then at that point, you can assign the non-responders into a different type of intervention. So maybe, for instance, you start people with semaglutide for obesity. And after 12 months, there are some people who haven't lost more than 10% of their body mass. And then at that point, you could introduce another body mass reducing intervention in conjunction with the semaglutide, whether that's some other pharmaceutical or whether that's some behavioral modification too. So maybe you introduce early time restricted eating along with an increased protein intake, for example.
Yeah. And no, I understand what you mean. And that's, you know, I went to an AI conference in San Francisco once, and there was someone there from Google talking about this, but they described it as a multi-arm bandit, right? Like it's like the one-arm bandit in the casino, only it's got multiple arms, right? So you're pulling lots of arms at once, and then you just cull the arms that are not yielding, which is, I think, what you just described.
Yeah, exactly. I much prefer that characterization too.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good, it's one that stuck with me, the idea of a multi-armed bandit. So is there anything else you've been pondering about psychedelics just before we wrap up?
Yeah, so a few things. I've got lots of thoughts on them, and I just think it's such a fascinating subject. But one of them is the effects of certain psychedelics that just haven't been that well studied. So anecdotally, a lot of people say that the experience having taken mescaline is unlike other psychedelics, and it's the most enjoyable of them. And if you look at the pharmacokinetics of it, then they're actually quite similar to something like psilocybin. And my guess is that psilocybin has some really favorable properties, such as the fact that the psilocybin trip after a high dose is something like 6 hours. I think that there's probably a sweet spot there. With some psychedelics, the trip is too short. With LSD, a 12-hour trip can...
Oh, it's crazy. That's why it's not studied so much, right? Yeah.
Exactly. But mescaline is quite similar to psilocybin. So I'm just curious to see more research on that. I think getting more information about the effects of the drugs in isolation with good placebo controls would be interesting, because most studies have been done under control conditions in conjunction with psychotherapy, which of course is going to offer lots of different positive effects. You get the rapport building, you get the feeling of safety, you get insights that you might not otherwise have gleaned, and so on. And there has been a bit of work recently looking at the effects of psilocybin in particular without extensive psychotherapy. So one of the widely discussed publications on treatment-resistant depression, it was a New England Journal of Medicine study from last year, didn't give people much support. And they did find a change in depression after 3 weeks. 3 weeks after taking 25 milligrams of psilocybin. But the suggestion on that study was that they might need repeated doses over time. I think that type of approach might make a lot of sense. You mentioned earlier, Chris, you can imagine taking these on a quarterly basis, say, I think for something like treatment-resistant depression, that type of approach might well turn out to be the way to go, and it might be really practical and scale well too. I think the ways to best prepare and integrate findings from these different experiences really need to be explored, and that includes looking at things like context. And what I mean by that is setting. So what are the types of music, for instance, that are most likely to occasion what you're after? There are also some big question marks about safety. And my impression is that these are, for the most part, very safe. Some have been used for thousands of years. I think there are some human remains found in some Texan caves that date back over 5,000 years, and they've been found to contain psychedelic alkaloids. So clearly we've been using them for quite some time. But nowadays, most use is either on the street, or maybe it's people engaging in psychedelic tourism. They go to a retreat in the Netherlands or maybe they go and they see a shaman in Peru and take ayahuasca there. But if you look at what we know about the safety data, then they do actually seem to be remarkably safe. And some of these analyses are far from perfect. But David Nutt published a really interesting review in 2010, where they looked at the relative harms of 20 different drugs according to 16 criteria they came up with in advance. So 9 of these focused on the harms to the user and 7 related to the harms to other people. And it was hilarious because 3 of the 4 least harmful drugs were MDMA, LSD, and psilocybin. And sure, there are flaws to that type of assessment, but it was actually a systematic approach that they took. And maybe they have some biases, but unsurprisingly, alcohol was the most damaging drug. And it does make me laugh and frustrate me at times when people can be quite anti-psychedelic while very happily drinking to their heart's content and witnessing the pitfalls of alcohol consumption on a weekly basis as they walk around the English streets on a Friday night. But obviously, yeah, there are some real potential harms to these. I think in the short term, there aren't substantial ones. I mean, you see an increase in things like blood pressure and heart rate. But people are concerned about whether taking psychedelics could trigger schizophrenia in people who are that way inclined, or psychosis, or bipolar disorder. And we really do need to try and work out if there are biomarkers that will predict risk of negative experiences taking these drugs. And then otherwise, I think we've probably largely touched on many of the other unknowns that I'm curious about in the course of this conversation, like whether there are entourage effects, for instance, and maybe some of the ways by which we can use these substances in conjunction with other interventions.
You know, the one caveat I might add is potential contamination, especially with fentanyl, might be a concern, especially for MDMA. Anything that's crushed into a pill kind of makes me a little bit nervous. You know, I've heard this is a thing now, and sometimes the amount of fentanyl in the substance can be like a lethal dose. So yeah, I don't really know what the answer there is, but it's certainly something to be aware of, especially with MDMA.
Yeah. Is fentanyl one of those drugs where the recreational dose is warranting close to a dose that could be lethal?
Yeah, and my understanding is it's in the microgram range, right? And you can easily be off by an order of magnitude and kill someone. Like, you're trying to make just a little bit more pokey, you know, give a sort of euphoric high with it, differentiate yourself from other products on the market. But in doing so, you kill a few people, you know. Like, I think that's probably less of a concern. You know, if you're buying whole dried mushrooms, like, this is probably not a concern. But if you're buying something that's crushed into a pill in a nightclub, then that's a very different story, right?
Yeah, which is why I also think that the fungi are a really good gateway drug, so to speak, people who are interested in this stuff. And obviously, we're not recommending that, but you also were kind of recommending it at the start when you said that everyone should have that experience at some point in their life, which frankly, I would probably, I'd probably largely back, maybe minus people with a really strong family history of certain psychiatric conditions.
And always within the confines of the law, obviously.
Obviously. That's why you need to get yourself out to Sumatra.
Exactly. Or decriminalized in Santa Cruz, I might add.
Is that right?
Yeah, mushrooms, decriminalized in Santa Cruz, yeah. And Oakland, there's a few other places in the US, I think.
Nice. Yeah, you progressive Californians.
I know, in some ways, but not others. You put a mask on your toddler, but yeah, mushrooms, you're okay. Well, this has been fantastic, Greg. I'm so glad that you agreed to do this for me. Tell us about where people can find you online. Do you have, like, what I'd really like is someplace where I could follow you to find out what you're working on and where I can hear you on. Like, I know you're really good at giving these interviews for podcasts, but they're not always in the same place, right? So is there somewhere I can find out about where you're publishing more content like this?
Yeah, they can find me, gregpotterphd.com. I use social media a little bit still, so mostly on Instagram. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned podcasts there. I'm still toying with the idea of starting my own. But otherwise, for the time being, if you want to stay up to date with different podcasts that I've been on, then Instagram is probably the best place. But otherwise, do feel free to just reach out to me via my website and I will get to you.
And you still have space for health coaching clients?
I do. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Just get in touch via the form on my site and we'll take it from there.
Excellent. Well, Greg, thank you so much. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.